Well, hello, and thanks for joining me today. This is the sixth Tim Mosso podcast, and I'm so happy to have you with me. We're going to be discussing the three most polarizing brands in watchmaking, a couple of fabulous firsts, and then the illusion of the Grail watch, and why I think there is more of a link between super watches and super cars than we might let on. So first, polarizing watch brands. There are a lot of them. This is by its very nature an emotional hobby, and for the most part, people tend to buy what they like. But every once in a while, there's a brand that equally inspires people to love it and to loathe it. I'm not talking about like and dislike. I'm talking about truly inflamed passions, like fighting words, things that would come to blows if we weren't mostly meeting each other on online forums and chat groups. So let's talk about the first and easily most polarizing of them all. And surprisingly, it's not a brand that starts with an R. That one's here, but I'm going to talk about a smaller brand that has sort of made its name on the back of outrage, and that's Hublot. The funny thing is, Hublot was founded as a company called MDM Genève, and its original product was the Hublot. Hublot, of course, porthole in French. And the watch itself was controversial from the beginning, not because it was big or bombastic, but because it combined a yellow gold case with a rubber strap. And that was a big deal, because what Audemars Piguet had done 8 years prior, taking a stainless steel watch, finishing it to a high horology standard, and then putting a car-sized price on it, that was controversial enough in its day. A steel watch that cost as much as a gold watch, never mind an expensive gold watch, that's exactly what it was. And it took people, admittedly, a few months to warm up to the new AP back in 1972 and 73. But by 1980, the ball was rolling, and the bar had been raised, and it was the combination of gold with rubber that offended tastes of the time. Interestingly, it wasn't the inclusion of a quartz movement. That wasn't considered to be inappropriate. The price of the watch was commensurate to the price of the material with which it was crafted. The rubber was thought to be the element that didn't belong back in 1980. The quartz movement, back in the midst of the quartz crisis, was exactly what a premium watch was expected to include. So it's interesting to see how perceptions shifted. First from Audemars Piguet and its steel luxury watch, then to Hublot and its gold watch with a rubber strap, but ultimately we wouldn't begin to insist on a mechanical movement in a proper luxury watch for, well, probably another half decade. So Hublot, to accelerate the story, limped through the 1990s after being very much an it watch brand and changing its name from MDM to Hublot proper during the 1980s. Hublot became something of a lost name in the 90s, and founder Carlo Crocco, by the early 2000s, was looking for a partner, not just someone to turn around the company, but someone who might be interested in taking some equity, paying him some cash, and ensuring that no matter how the Hublot saga ended, Carlo got some money for his trouble. Well, Jean-Claude Biver, at that point, was coming out of retirement. He had been an industry consultant in the late 70s, and he and the principal of the Frédéric Piguet manufacturer had jointly purchased Blancpain after Blancpain proper went bankrupt in the 70s. So what he actually bought, I think it was him and Jean-Jacques Piguet, but what they bought was a 20,000 Swiss franc pile of copyrights in a box. So it was essentially a brand in a box and a total recommissioning. And by combining Piguet's movements with newly styled Blancpain watches, they were able to relaunch the brand, which basically died during the quartz crisis, and they were able to relaunch it in the midst of the 1980s mechanical watch revival. So while they liked to tout the fact that they had never previously made a quartz watch and never would, the fact of the matter is they probably would have if they hadn't been totally bankrupt. So Blancpain is revived. Mechanical watches, luxury watches. The first watch, the Blancpain Moonphase, was a breakthrough product for them, and ultimately that case design, a generation down the line, would become the Blancpain Le Mans line. So that was Biver's first big score, reviving Blancpain, and then in 1992, selling it to Omega for 60 million Swiss francs. Again, then as now, impressive. He became the president of Omega and pioneered the relentless marketing, celebrity ambassador, and event sponsorship of the 1990s. Michael Schumacher, James Bond, George Clooney, all of that, and the watches that went with them. But to be fair, there was also a good run of product success during that period, most of it driven by the rising Seamaster line, whose fortune soared with its appearances on the wrist of 007. Bivera then retired. That was the end of his career, and he figured that he would retire to his farm, his dairy farm, and make cheese for the rest of his natural life. But Croco approached him and offered him two things: equity and a chance to run the brand outright. And so Bivera got on board with Hublot in 2004. He became a managing partner, CEO, and significant stakeholder. His first watch demonstrated a grasp of what the brand did best and also a hint of where it was going to go. And that was the Super B, a bigger, bolder version of the 1980 Hublot. This was a chronograph with a rubber bezel, a rubber strap, and at 42 millimeters, it was considered to be an enormous piece at the time. That was nothing. 2005 brought the watch that would ultimately make Bivera one of the richest men in watchmaking, and that was the Big Bang. It was a simple thing. 44 millimeters, ceramic bezel, steel case, rubber strap, and a Valjoux 7750 movement. It was, in effect, a cheaper version of the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Offshore. If any one watch were the source material for the Hublot Big Bang, it was the Offshore. But at a lower price point, in an industry where borrowing is almost considered part and parcel to the business model, it was a big success. And in that era, the mid-2000s, when bigger was better and biggest was best, the Big Bang was a superstar. Instantly, it built the Hublot brand. It attracted the attention of LVMH, which in 2008 bought out Bivera and Croco, making both of them richer than they'd ever been. But Bivera stayed on board to run the company and ultimately became one of the chieftains of LVMH watchmaking. 2008 was also the year Hublot launched a watch that would probably define Hublot excess. And this was probably where Hublot jumped the sharp a little bit in the eyes of watch collectors, and it was the 48 millimeter King Power. The name alone was a little bit offensive to the sensibility of those who are maybe traditional enthusiasts, but at 48 millimeters, powered by initially a Valjoux movement, but later by Hublot's own Unico, it did seem like a little bit of a rush to cash, and it was that, to be fair. But also to be fair, this was a period when Audemars Piguet had multiple 48 millimeter references dedicated to, among others, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Shaq, so Hublot was hardly alone. But Hublot was, in many regards, the poster child for the 2000s, a period of excess on every level. The Hummer H2 SUV, subprime mortgages, mortgage-backed bonds, which became a global sort of economic contagion. And of course, watches that were too big for their own good and, frankly, for our own wrists. Fast forward to the present day, and Hublot is probably the best pure watchmaker on a watchmaking basis that it's been since 1980. Today, Hublot has the Masterpiece division, which is only about 2% of sales, but is legit high horology, and run by Matthias Boutet. It is an effective continuation of the old B&B concept, high horology manufacturer that went bust in 2010. Hublot bought it and brought it in-house, which is all to Hublot's credit, because it could have easily continued to farm this out to subcontractors, but it brought high horology in-house. Of course, we have not just the Unico, which is available today in both the Big Bang and the more popular Classic Fusion, but we now have a Unico 1280 caliber, which is a thinner, finer, more compact and more elegant packaging of the Unico. And the Unico is a legitimate luxury horology movement. 72-hour power reserve, silicon escapement, flyback capability, a 60-minute register, which is uncommon with chronographs, column wheel, lateral clutch, hacking seconds, quick set date, and at about 6.85 millimeters thick now with the Unico 2, the 1280, it is a impressively integrated and fairly thin automatic chronograph that I would even go so far as to mention alongside the Piguet 1185, which, while comparably thin, is also technically inferior to the Unico. But there is something about the Hublot brand that makes people just see red. I don't know if it's the legacy of those fashionista watches in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, or the reputation it built for itself as a little bit of an emulator of popular styles from more innovative brands. But it is the kind of brand that will immediately cause otherwise civilized friends online, especially those who don't know each other in physical congregations, but it will cause people to come almost to blows. There is a prolonged impression of Hublot that I think is undeserved at this point, that it is really just a branding effort, that the movements are bought, the watches are cheap, the styles are borrowed, and no matter what it does, Hublot can never be legitimate. And I think we kind of need to get over that, not just because they have a high horology division, and not just because from the Caliber 1300 Ultra Thin to the 1280 Unico 2 to the Mecca 10 10-day, not just because they make their own movements, but I really think Hublot has come into its own and evolved as a watch brand. First, look at the rise of the Classic Fusion. Launched in the late 2000s, it was the closest thing at the time to a revival of the original 1980 MDM Hublot watch. The style was similar, the watches were thinner, the size, while on paper 44 millimeters, was actually more compact on the wrist, and often available in titanium. These were lighter, stripped-down, thinner watches, often using an ETA 2894 or a 2892 with the DD module, which made them a lot thinner than the Valjoux-powered Big Bangs. And Hublot's been moving towards beauty in its design, lineup. Look at the Classic Fusion Ferrari GT. Now, continuing a trend that Hublot started with the Tech Frame Tourbillon of 2 years prior, you get a design that is actually penned by the Centro Stile at Ferrari. And the result is gorgeous. It looks more expensive than every other Hublot watch, even though at face value, it's not. It's priced like other Hublot timepieces, but it looks like something that might have hailed from Audemars Piguet. It's downright beautiful, and that is not something I would have said about previous Hublot watches. Even the most successful concepts, like the 2007 Magbang magnesium watch with titanium and aluminum components and a titanium and aluminum movement, that was very cool. But ultimately, it wasn't as holistically satisfying as the Classic Fusion Ferrari GT. And whichever version of that watch you're looking at, titanium or gold or carbon, it comes across as elegant. And I would not have applied the E word to any Bever era Hublot, which proves not only has Hublot grown as a manufacturer and as a design house, but it has also grown past Jean-Claude Bever. And I think, frankly, that's a good thing. The football sponsorships, the celebrity ambassadors, the product placements, the enormous size, the open skeletonized dials, I thought it ran its course. And I'm frankly glad to see Hublot willing to give the con, as we would say in the Navy, that is the wheel of the ship, to someone else. Bringing in Ferrari was a great start. I hope going forward, Hublot recognizes the success of that arrangement, the success of its arrangement with the Orlinsky series of artist-inspired watches, with the Sangbleu series of artist-inspired watches. And I would love to see that become an Hublot signature, the same way it's a Nomos signature. Nomos hires ace designers who are not in-house talent. And the result has been spectacular, a brand known for design. Hublot can be that and a legitimate movement manufacturer. Now, Rolex. This is a controversial brand. Controversial in as much as there are people who love and people who hate. And I would think in terms of the raw numbers, more people love Rolex than love any other brand. And more people hate Rolex than hate any other brand. And to a large extent, this is a product of the modern era. We talked about Bever reviving Blancpain in the 80s. Well, it was the 1980s that really made Rolex what it is today. While always a premium option, Rolex GMT pilots' watches were never the cheapest pilots' watches. The Submariners and the Sea Dwellers were never the cheapest dive watches. Their Oyster cases were never the cheapest water-resistant cases, but they were never super premium. When the Cellini line debuted in the 1960s, it was a novel concept. The idea that a person might have more than one Rolex had never really been broached by the company proper, and the arrival in 1964 of the outrageously priced integrated bracelet Full Gold Ultra Thin Midas. It wasn't a Cellini at first, but the Midas was an haute de gamme dress watch from Rolex, which had never done anything like that. And the arrival of the Cellini line shortly thereafter was Rolex's first tentative step towards making luxury watches, but they were dress watches. It wasn't until the 1980s when A, mechanical watchmaking became seen as something rare and exclusive, and B, Rolex suddenly became a totem of status, that Rolex as a brand was transformed from a manufacturer of high-grade watches that were generally considered leaders in their class to a brand that was almost entirely a purveyor to the status conscious and upwardly mobile. This was not true even when the Sub was far more expensive than, say, a Breitling Super Ocean or an Omega Seamaster in the 60s. The arrival of two-tone, the proliferation of more full gold Rolex models, the creation of novelties like the triple gold Rolex Tridor Day-Date, this marked the true emergence in the Gordon Gekko era. And you know what that means, but the emergence of Rolex as a polarizing brand, because whenever you have a luxury facet, there are going to be those who love and those who hate. It's true with Rolex as a watchmaker. It's true with Tiffany and Harry Winston as jewelers. It is true with Mercedes-Benz as a car maker. There are some places in the world where a Mercedes-Benz that is not a taxi will immediately get keyed or get its hood ornament pulled off. And that's just a reflection of the fact that mainstream luxury brands that are seen as more than luxury, but symbolic, they truly inflame opinion. Now, here's the thing about Rolex. As many people hate it for being a status symbol, that many more people love it for being true to its history, which it always is, faithful to its customers by never overproducing a model, and possessed of a legitimate history that it always remembers. Rolex history is real. Rolex didn't invent the water-resistant watch, but it perfected and popularized the type. Rolex didn't invent the automatic winding watch, but it perfected and popularized the type. Rolex didn't invent the wristwatch, but again, it was one of the major popularizers. And during the 1950s, Rolex did not invent the dive watch, but it helped to forge ahead in the segment with design, engineering, and above all, marketing with the Submariner that got people talking about recreational dive watches in a way that, for example, Blancpain never did. So Rolex was a true pioneer, and as a foundation, and technically Rolex is controlled by a tax-exempt charitable foundation, it has a degree of independence and integrity to it that you won't find at, for example, Omega with its exchange traded group ownership, or at Jaeger-LeCoultre, which, though it has a great history, is ultimately also part of a luxury group that is exchange traded, publicly held, and subject to the whims of investors and the vagaries of the market. So Rolex has integrity, real history, a respect for that history. And if you look at Rolex production, that stupid term Rolex shortage gets thrown around a lot. Every brand should be lucky enough to have a shortage. I look at Vacheron Constantin, some of the most beautifully made watches in the world, and then I despair at their retail versus resale depreciation. I look at Glashütte Original, which makes the whole watch right down to the dial. And again, I despair at the fact that these watches get discounted right out of their own boutiques. A Lange & Söhne, the most beautiful watches in the world, and you can get a 30% discount right out of the boutique. The factory store is going to give you 1/3 off. Why? Because at some point, generally a point where investors and corporate governors got involved, the decision was made to push watches out the back end rather than selling them out the front end for full retail. Rolex will never do that. And there are two beneficiaries to that. One is Rolex itself, which always maintains its premium image. And again, when you're a foundation ownership versus publicly traded, you can do that. Second, if you buy a Rolex Submariner right now in 2021, 1 year, not even, a few months into current generation Rolex Submariner production, if you buy that watch and you sell it for more than you bought it for at retail, Rolex has taken care of you. Because rather than cranking up production and throwing open the floodgates, Rolex is willing to forego some profit in the short term to protect both its reputation and the customer's investment in the watch. And every brand should do that. Moreover, if you look at what Rolex charges for its products, frankly, it is being very fair. The Submariner still retails for under $10,000, even though, for example, the Kermit can easily pull over $20,000 used. The Daytona, $13,150, and Rolex watches these sell used weeks out of the case or even days out of the dealer's case for twice that price. When you can pay $26,000 for a new Daytona and still get Rolex to promise you one for $13,000, that's integrity. I'll also say this, Rolex controls its dealers, which is why you don't see as much transshipping of Rolex, discounting of Rolex, or, and this is just as important, markups. When you're looking at, for example, franchisees selling popular cars, that Ford Mustang Bullitt might roll out the door at $20,000, $30,000 above retail. And if you want the car, you have no choice but to pay the ransom. With Rolex, not only do they check to make sure that their dealers sell the watches at least the recommended retail price, they also make sure that price gouging is not taking place. And that's something precious few watch brands will bother to do. And that is why, though Rolex is often viewed as a loathsome totem of status symbol, a symbol of wretched excess for chattering and elite moneyed classes, the leisure set's favorite watch, the fact remains that from a pure watch enthusiast perspective, you can get just as engaged and just as heated and animated in your defense of Rolex as you can trying to slag down the brand for being a status symbol that, while expensive, we have to admit, isn't nearly as expensive as the market seems to indicate a Rolex watch should be. And let's be honest, the Rolex shortage is also our fault. While people slate Rolex for not making enough Subs, GMTs, now Oyster Perpetuals, and Daytonas, the fact is Yachtmasters, Air Kings, and Milgauss Datejust 36s are still very easy to get. Oftentimes, you can walk into a dealer and find them in the case. Oftentimes, you can walk into a dealer and find a steel Skydweller in the case. You can find a steel Yachtmaster 2 in the case, and these are great watches. Maybe the problem also lies with us in our inability to open our eyes and open our minds to the possibilities of watches that are just as appealing. I've often said that if you open up a browser and start searching and scrolling and immersing yourself in any brand and any model, you can become just as immersively obsessed in those brands and models as the mainstream person is going to be in a Rolex Submariner. Try it sometime with the Yachtmaster, the Yachtmaster 2, the Explorer 2, the Skydweller. Try it with the Milgauss or the Air King. Heck, try it with Arnold & Son. I guarantee you, once you start educating yourself, you will become an enthusiast and ultimately an evangelist for what is uncommon and uncommonly appreciated. Now, finally, we need a high horology brand that's polarizing. And I think right here, Grubel Forsey is a great example. The thing about Grubel Forsey is that its watches represent extremes of price, of size, of exclusivity, of fine finish, of technical complexity, of styling idiosyncrasies. Grubel Forsey watches are, without a doubt, the most polarizing ultra haute de gamme pieces, high horology, and independent watchmaking options you can buy. Even Konstantin Chaikin, with his Russian-inflected collection of watches, is probably about as mainstream as Grubel Forsey could ever hope to be. Because with the Clown watch, Chaikin has at least one watch that has met mainstream approval. Whereas Grubel Forsey, almost model by model, inflames opinions. And it started back in 2004 with the very first Grubel Forsey model, the 2004 Double Tourbillon 30 Degrees. Now, a quick bit of background here. Grubel Forsey was founded by Robert Grubel of France and Stephen Forsey of the United Kingdom. Grubel formerly of Audemars Piguet Renault et Papy, specializes in styling the watches for Grubel Forcey. And Stephen Forcey, who is formerly a watch restorer, he is mostly the tech guru at Grubel Forcey, as well as the spokesman for the brand. Both of them were partners in a brand called Completime. So in addition to coming up through Audemars Piguet Renault et Papy and Aspre, with restoration and ultra haute de gamme work being done for AP, Grubel and Forcey ran Completime and retained control of it. So it provided a source of funds as an engineering house to Grubel Forcey, the brand, which is a little bit like how for its first 25 years or so, Porsche was able to compete with giants and advance the state of the art in technology because it owned so many old Volkswagen patents. And it was able to have, for example, the Weissach Tech Center and the race department because it was effectively leeching patent royalties off of the millions of Volkswagens being sold. So Grubel Forcey never had to be totally profitable in its own right. And this gave Grubel and Forcey unlimited legere de main, or free reign, to create watches that were idiosyncratic, individual, and different, as well as ruinously expensive. So their first watch, the Double Tourbillon 30 Degrees, absolutely blew minds. It was 43.5 millimeters. It contained not one, but two tourbillons, coaxial. One a four-minute tourbillon, one a one-minute tourbillon, the balance inclined at 30 degrees, everything that wasn't satinated and media blasted or wire brush frosted was black polished. It had blued screws. It had polished screws, interior angles, exterior angles, movement depth like nothing ever seen, and idiosyncratic styling features like a half-open dial or a frequency wave on the side of the case designed to suggest the double tourbillon oscillations inside. It was a unique look, style, level of finish, and absolute denial of compromise from two guys who didn't have to play right out of the gate for the approval of investors or the cash of clients. And it was a big success. Ultimately, it inspired them to create watches for the ultra rich. Today, in 2021, just about the cheapest Grubel Forcey you can buy is the Balancier S sports watch, which costs roughly $200,000. So on a pricing basis alone, folks are going to react against Grubel Forcey because whatever Rolex is from a status standpoint, Grubel Forcey is, but by an order of magnitude greater. Now, Grubel Forcey is also idiosyncratic. Perhaps you might have seen one of the art pieces with a miniature sculpture and magnification glass featuring a tiny handmade sculpture by British artist Willard Wiggin. Perhaps you've seen the Fluxus tribute. Perhaps you've seen one of their quadruple tourbillons. Yes, not one, not two, not three, but four tourbillons in one watch. It defies parody. It is almost a parody of the excesses of the 2000s. And in 2009, Grubel and Forcey released a watch with four tourbillon regulators. Excessive? Yeah. Monstrously complex? Well, with 531 components and 63 jewels, very much. And from a style standpoint, we began to see the emergence of idiosyncrasy in case design from Grubel Forcey, not just in the size, but in the tumor-like appurtenances of little swells, nasals, and pods on the flank of the case. So basically, circles protruding out from the flank of the primary circle of the case. We saw all sorts of weird arrangements of super graphics. If you ever pick up a Grubel Forcey watch, it is like a horological billboard, an odd sort of advertising to the guy who's already bought the watch. If you've ever complained that a watch dial had an extraneous amount of printing, for example, advertising automatic to the person who already knows his watch is self-winding, or with Rolex, Rolex Oyster Perpetual, superlative chronometer, officially certified. Well, again, all of this is small beer compared to the hard liquor of Grubel Forcey's particular dedication to graphics. When you pick up a Grubel Forcey watch, front, back, on the barrel of the movement itself, even on the clasp and the case flank, you find all sorts of references to savoir-faire, technicité, bienfaitre, all sorts of French language ultra exposition of exactly what's going on inside the minds of Robert Grubel and Stephen Forsey. And frankly, if you thought Rolex dial print was a bit of a tome and unnecessary, Grubel Forsey will make your eye water, as the number of characters on a Grubel Forsey watch would likely exceed the limit of a tweet. So we're talking an extraordinary amount of text, and all of it somewhat esoteric. If you didn't already think that the standard of finish, of style, of open dials, weirdness like fluxus, miniature sculptures, and micro foudrian hands, if you didn't think all of that was a little bit weird, the sheer amount that you can read off of a Grubel Forsey case, dial, and movement is going to put off some folks who would otherwise have the money to pay seven figures for some of these watches. So while Grubel and Forsey have created unquestionably extraordinary watches, they are weird looking pieces. Now, in their defense, Grubel and Forsey have also built remarkably discreet watches. Back in 2007, Robert Grubel acknowledged that a lot of the style features of the original double tourbillon 30 degrees were alienating folks who didn't want a bombastic open dial watch or a visible dial side tourbillon. So he created the double tourbillon 30 degrees secret. In 2014, Grubel Forsey won the GPHG and they won the Aiguille d'Or with a variation on an existing model. This was the Grubel Forsey Tourbillon 24 Second Vision, a stripped down, minimalist Grubel Forsey. And ultimately, they would go even smaller with watches like the Signature Piece 1, created by Didier Cretin, which was 39.5 millimeters. Ultimately, they would even offer titanium and steel for those who didn't want platinum or gold. All of this was an olive branch to those who loved their uncompromising standard of finish, the inward angles, the exterior angles, the 100 Swiss franc screws, the acres of black polish, the German silver bridges, the frosted finish, the dyed titanium blue entire swaths of movement. But Grubel Forsey did eventually create some olive branches with smaller watches, simpler watches, more discreet watches, which is to say, for a company that only makes 100 watches a year, they have a remarkable range of styles. And for those who think the GMT is ugly, the sonnerie is excessive, or Four Tourbillon is almost a shame on the wrist parody of itself, the reality is that Grubel Forsey is also remarkably willing to acknowledge its own excess and make amends to those who might have the means and the will to buy the best, but don't share Robert Grubel's particular idiosyncratic vision of what the best should look like in its most extreme form. Grubel is willing to step back and meet collectors halfway. Guys, I think that's just about all I can say. I've got some other ideas for future podcasts, but I think we've just about run our course at 33 minutes. So I'm going to save that material and keep my powder dry for the next time. Thanks so much. Be sure to tune in on Mondays at 5 p.m. U.S. Eastern for Watches Tonight, a flagship live show. And of course, you're going to want to check out TMasso at thewatchbox.com, which is your purchase and pricing question line for anything you see on any Watchbox platform. Guys, thanks so much. Time out, Tim out. Thanks for logging on.